loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we turn to Brazil. Far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro won the presidential election in Brazil yesterday. The voting included, though, 30% blank ballots. Bolsonaro admires Hitler and supports the military dictatorship that ruled Brazil in the past. What does this election mean for the country and the region? And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garofa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Robert Bowers walked into the Tree of Life Synagogue on Saturday in Pittsburgh and opened fire with an AR-15 assault rifle. He's now facing 29 felony counts, including 11 counts of murder, with a hate crime enhancement. And the U.S. attorney says that he will seek the federal death penalty. Bowers is virulently anti-Semitic, and his online posts presaged the attack. Next, The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that the number of troops the U.S. is sending to the border in anticipation of a migrant caravan is up from the reported 800 last week to 5,000. They're joining 2,000 National Guardsmen already there. Meanwhile, Mexican officials say that the size of the caravan has dropped by half as some migrants are electing to remain in Mexico's southern Chiapas state. Then, German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced this morning that she would resign from the leadership of the Christian Democratic Party in December and would not seek re-election as chancellor in 2021. The announcement was unexpected, but comes in light of a resounding defeat for Merkel's coalition in recent regional elections in Bavaria. And then, the fight for stronger rent control in California appears to be headed for defeat. Proposition 10 would repeal the state's Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, which strictly limits rent control in cities across California. It's blamed for the state having some of the highest rents in the country, but the latest polls show that Prop 10 will likely be defeated 60-40. And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, the U.S. Supreme Court today declined to take up for consideration an appeal from Pennsylvania Republicans to reinstate their congressional district maps. A state court ruled the map unlawfully biased toward Republicans. The Supreme Court's declination to rule on the matter means that the maps remain thrown out and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's redrawn map will be used moving forward. Yet another suspicious package was found today in an Atlanta mail facility addressed to CNN. If connected to the spate of pipe bombs mailed to CNN, former Secretary of State Clinton, President Obama, billionaire George Soros, and others, this would raise the number of mailed bombs to over a dozen. Suspect Cesar Sayoc was arrested in Plantation, Florida on Friday and is in court today. The incoming president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said today that he would cancel an ongoing $14 billion spending project for a new airport. Mexicans voted against the project in a non-binding referendum yesterday, and 69% came out against. López Obrador says the funds will be used to improve existing facilities. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Brazil. Far-right politician Jair Bolsonaro won the presidency of Brazil yesterday with 55% of valid votes cast. 30% of Brazilians cast blank ballots. Bolsonaro is seen as a right-wing so-called populist and has been compared to Donald Trump and to Philippines President Duterte. He has also spoken warmly of Brazil's 1964 military dictatorship and said recently that he would have served in Hitler's army if he had had the chance. We're joined from Philadelphia by João Rodrigues. João is a longtime political activist in Brazil. And we're joined from Sao Paulo, Brazil, by Aline Piva. She is a journalist and a member of Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
João, let's start with you. Anyway, big picture, stunning development, of course. if Lula had been allowed to run instead of been incarcerated, he certainly would have won this election. But instead of a progressive left-wing Lula and Workers' Party candidate, we have apparently Hitler-loving Bolsonaro as the president of Brazil. Anyway, just give us your initial big-picture thoughts. We're going to try to break down the situation, parse what's happened, and especially and specifically what it means going forward for the people of Brazil and for the region. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for having me in the first place. I think it's very important that we understand that a lot of like how a low tier congressman such as Bolsonaro made it to president in such a short period of time, like until a couple of years ago, he was this not known person. But then I think that his rise to power is extremely connected to the process through which the weakening of institutions that have happened since impeachment former President Dilma in 2016. It was mostly because she was letting investigations move forward with a car wash, and people were getting convicted. So she got outcast for that.
Let me just, Joao, for our audience, break that down a little bit. So the car wash investigation was an investigation that Dilma Rousseff, the Workers' Party candidate who had won the presidency succeeding Lula, she allowed that to go forward. That car wash investigation was going to and was naming important politicians who were guilty of graft and corruption. So they impeached her for corruption. In other words, that's what you're saying. That's what got this political ball rolling in this direction.
Yeah, exactly. She was said to have been impeached. The excuse for her impeachment was some budgetary fiscal maneuver, but that was actually made by virtually every president before her, and it was made by President Temer after her, and was legalized right after he got to power. So the real reasons why she was outcasted from office was mostly for the things that the Workers' Party did right, rather than the mistakes that were several. So in this climate of institutional crisis and chaos, it's where right-wing populist Bolsonaro finds a way to be to have a national progression. And it's interesting to point out that in this process, that people think that the left was the one that was, they were getting rid of the Workers' Party, they were getting rid of the left. This entire process, the ones that got the hardest hit was the Democratic right, because they saw their numbers and representation shrink and now in current elections. So the Democratic right and center right, they had to either adhere to the populist left, to the populist right discourse and more far right discourse, or they were wiped out of the political scene. I mean, not completely, but they were the ones that in this election showed that they were the ones that suffered the hardest hit.
Alina Piva, what about that? I mean, yes, the center right and the not far right, maybe they lost votes to Bolsonaro, but in terms of the big picture, where does this go from here in terms of who's sort of in the crosshairs?
So when you look at what happened yesterday, and I mean, it is bad, but it wasn't something that, unexpected turnout of events. You see that what people did yesterday, they cast an unsystemic vote. It was, a protest vote against everything that is there. That is something that we have been hearing a lot here in Brazil. You know, we don't want everything that is there. We need something that is new. What they fail to see or to realize is that Bolsonaro is nothing new. I mean, he has been in public office for 27 years. So he does not represent, change. But on the other hand, this Congress, the Congress that was elected this year for the lower and upper houses, is the biggest change that we had since redemocratization. Workers' Party is still the biggest caucus, but still there are new people coming in. I think that is going to represent some sort of challenge for Bolsonaro. But then again, he has the majority. And then from there, he can do whatever he wants.
You know, I've heard this a number of times, that this was a protest vote. But I have to ask, are Brazilians in general as worried about what this protest vote might lead to as so many Americans are, like we are? I mean, we've been having this awful experience with Donald Trump. We saw what happened with a populist in the Philippines, and now there's another populist in Brazil. I understand the concept of a protest vote, sure, but this is a guy who said he would have joined Hitler's army. This is a guy who's expressed admiration for the military junta that controlled the country from 1964 to 1985. Have people really thought this through?
I don't think so. I think we are living probably the biggest psychic operations, you know, from recent history. Everything is relativized. So when he says he wants to torture or kill people, people respond and point that out to other people, and they just respond, yeah, okay, he said that, but you know, he's not going to actually do that. So they have this sentiment, this mood that has been manipulated throughout the years. And now this is the expression of that manipulation.
Yeah. Mr. Rodriguez, go ahead. What's your view on all that?
My take on that is that people are basically being moved. The people that voted for Bolsonaro are basically moved by two, like, main drivers, which would be fear and hatred. So there are the people that are really that some of the people really do align with this mindset of torture and human rights for humans that are like good citizens and so on. But also, I think there are people that are willing to let that put a blind eye on that more oppressive, sexist, misogynistic, and racist discourse and rant. But because they have this concrete fear of rising insecurity and fear of the higher levels of robbery and all of that. So I think that there is this two type of voters. And so he was able to channel those main drivers and use it in this anti-corruption, anti-politics discourse that seduced people to go with him. But at the same time that he has this moralistic views, he's not doing, if you look through his campaign project and all of that, like his government plan of government, it's a very anti-people plan of government. So people are not realizing what they're voting for because they're thinking they're buying something, but they're actually buying less labor rights, they're buying less social security, less education. He has already spoken about just online and distance education for students, for public students, for students that go to public schools in more rural areas. So people are not realizing the breadth and the deepness of the effects of that our Bolsonaro administration might bring.
Brian, we talk a lot about fascism, not just us, but people around the country. Is this fascism?
Well, that's what I want to get back to that topic, John. And I want to say a few words and then ask Aline about her view on it. One thing is we can see that Bolsonaro historically was a small-time politician. Here we had the ruling Workers' Party, which was democratically elected four times in a row, which had a center-left political orientation, certainly an anti-racist orientation, an orientation that was sympathetic and supportive to workers, to the indigenous populations, to the rights of women, etc. Now that party was put into disarray as the ruling party as a consequence of a hit job by the right wing through the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff and the incarceration of the historic leader of the Workers' Party, Lula, who's in jail right now and as a consequence couldn't run. Now, Lula says he's innocent. All the evidence seems to point to his innocence. He could not run. So there's this political vacuum. And a political vacuum, when there's a period of political and social unresolved crisis, allows other seemingly and previously minor politicians like Bolsonaro, or in the case of Germany in the late 1920s, early 1930s, Adolf Hitler, who was a minor politician, to fill a void. And their extreme positions in the case of Hitler were such that at a certain point, the real power in Germany, the industrial elites, the banking elites, decided to opt for Hitler as a way to use extreme solutions to end the crisis in German society. My question to Aline, and I think when I look at Brazil, it seems far different to me than what it looked like in Nazi Germany in 1929 and 1930 and 31. It seems to me that there's a situation where the political left has been cast into disarray. People don't know what's going on, that there's confusion, but at the same time, Bolsonaro, in spite of his hard right, far right views, doesn't have the kind of sort of plebeian, lower class militia forces as Hitler had to attack the left and progressive forces. If anything, Bolsonaro, though, could be a segue, like an accidental, a momentary candidate, whereby eventually the military itself, if the crisis in society continues to go unresolved, the military itself could take the power once again, not necessarily as a fascist mass movement, but as a right-wing military dictatorship. Anyway, what are your thoughts? You're also, Alina, pointing to the countervailing trends, suggesting all is not lost and that the left might actually be able to make a comeback here.
I think you were exactly right, Brian. It's really important to understand that this is not a mass movement. When you look at the numbers at the poll yesterday, 40 million people did not turn out, did not vote for Bolsonaro. He had, you know, roughly 30-something in the lower 30s, a percentage of voters. Another difference that I see from the fascism from last century is that we are not talking about a nationalistic project. We are talking about someone that is just a puppet for bigger interests. Might that be from national elites, but I think it's playing an important role in geopolitics. And having Brazil under someone that is so willingly trying to get attention from the likes of Trump, it's very important for the U.S. interests in the region.
All right. Joao Rodrigues is our other guest. That was Alina Piva. She's a journalist and a member of the Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. She's talking to us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. We're talking also with Joao Rodrigues. Joao is a longtime political activist in Brazil. Joao, again, same question to you. Do you see it in terms of the evolution of fascism, the forces, the power, the potentialities of the left to make a comeback? Where are we right now in the trajectory politically in Brazil?
Well, I think that this election has brought up, similarly to what happened to the U.S., has brought up the very ugly side of our society that has connections to fascism. So I don't think that this is, I think that it is a movement that's happening in Brazil. But also, I do agree with Lini when she says that it's not necessarily the majority of the population. There are a lot of people that are just lost in this process, but there are, and also people that are against it. It's important to say that the left has not been wiped out of this process, because if you see over 40, I think it was 45 million that, or something to that degree, like voted for Fernando Haddad, which was the Workers' Party candidate for the presidency. Regardless of not having the same charisma as Lula, you see that there was organization and there was movement towards a left-leaning or a unification of the left. So I think that this election will have an effect of unifying the left, which I think that is one of the most important things that can happen right now. So the left has to go through this reflective and self-criticism moment and understand and organize toward the next steps in the future. So I don't think things are completely lost. I think that there's the flip side of this election, which is a very bad moment in Brazilian history, which I do think that might be, at some point, be risks to democracy itself and open room for a possible authoritarian regime. But we're not completely there yet. I think there are ways ahead of how we can organize and change this. So I think that the left is already pointing towards that movement. Like, the leaderships that were backing Haddad are from the different spectrums of the left. And I think that this is the movement that might be happening in Brazil right now, too.
Yeah, Alina, go ahead.
I completely agree. But I think we need to see that there is an escalation on the political persecution in the country. We saw assassinations, we saw intimidation. We are seeing the military taking the streets. So yes, I completely agree. There was a movement that kind of start to happen in this second round of the campaign, but there is also going to be a lot of challenges. And I think we can't take out of the analysis the possibility that there is going to be, you know, assassinations and persecutions and so forth.
Yeah, I want to ask both of you. I'm looking at a Reuters article. More violence feared as Brazil braces for far-right presidency. Here it is. It's from Sao Paulo, where you are, Aline. It's a Reuters story. After a presidential campaign that has seen political violence overshadow policy debate, many Brazilians fear attacks will continue after the likely election on Sunday. This was before the election of tough-talking far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro supporters in recent weeks have threatened to harm Supreme Court justices and physically attack journalists and opposition voters. There has also been violence attributed to the backers of Bolsonaro's opponent, they say Haddad of the Workers' Party, but to a far lesser extent. Again, it seems to me that, and I want to go back to the German example, because there's, along with Italy, the example of classic fascism. And I'm not being predictive here. I'm not saying, in fact, I'm saying the opposite. I don't think Brazil right now is like Nazi Germany in 1931 or 32. But that doesn't mean things can't happen dynamically. If the left is continuing to be assaulted, either by paramilitary forces or extra-legal forces or the police or the army, then it poses this question to the left. The government won't defend you. The police won't defend you. Must you, in fact, defend yourself? Will there be the self-organization of progressive and left forces who, up until the ouster of Dilma and the imprisonment of Lula, would have counted on the democratic process, the electoral process, as the way forward? Obviously, if the electoral process seems to be cut off because of these extra-legal judicial coup d'etats and false imprisonment of the leaders, does everything start to become more polarized, and does the left, as a consequence, have to reorganize itself on a different basis? Anyway, that's a question to both of you.
You know, Brian, people during this electoral process, there was a lot of criticism on why the Workers' Party was insisting on maintaining Lula until the last minute as the party candidate. And one thing that I think that it was a very intelligent move, because that forced, you know, the institutions in the country to kind of defend themselves of a, you know, defenseless position. You know, they needed to again and again say, we understand this is not perfect, but we have to do this. But why you have to do this? And that led people thinking, you know, there is something wrong going on. More than what happened during the coup against Rousseff, now this electoral process showed that the institutions are working closely with the coup mongers and this new liberal fascism that is rising in the country. So I think that is something that made people realize that we have to do something. We can't wait for, you know, a higher power to come and put us back on track again. If we don't organize, if we don't take the streets, and if we don't protect ourselves, you know, there's no hope.
Joao, same question to you.
Yeah, going back to that, I think that the escalation of violence has already happened. Even before the second round of elections, we've had over 50 attacks of people that perpetrated by people that voted by Bolsonaro voters against people that somehow expressed their opinion against him. So in Bahia, for instance, Mestre de Moa was stabbed to death after getting into a discussion with Bolsonaro's supporter. So I think that these things are already happening. And there's also at the University of Brasilia, they wrote in a bathroom that if Bolsonaro wins, this is going to be Columbine. So really attaching to U.S. realities of violence and extremism. So I think that this is something that is really happening in Brazil right now. It happened before I think that people felt empowered throughout the electoral process. And I think that now that Bolsonaro has just won, people are going to have this fuel. But going back to the left, I think that as of now, since we're still precariously, but still under the democratic system, I think the left will continue to both point towards the bias of the judiciary, but still try to go through the institutional means to will point the bias, but also go through institutional means to try and protect the rights and liberties in general of association, of free thinking, and all of that.
Alina Pive, just quick question. Will Brazil under Bolsonaro stay in or leave the BRICS?
I think it's staying, but it's going to try to undermine it more than did so far.
We were listening to Aline Piva and Joao Rodriguez about the Bolsonaro victory in Brazil. But before we close out the segment, I want to share a few remarks of my own. I think what we see happening in Brazil with the ascendancy of Bolsonaro, of the right wing, it's not unique, not at all. All around the world right now, we see the rise of ultra-right nationalist forces devoid of a real left, devoid of a strong socialist left in particular, based on the labor movement, based on the working class. And in the situation whereby the traditional parties of the center-right and social democratic parties have adopted more and more the position of neoliberal capitalism, rising discontent, rising anger, the inability to mitigate the terrible impact of the capitalist economic crisis that continues to devastate whole countries, whole communities, we see the ultra-right filling the void. That was not necessarily the case in Brazil, however. In Brazil, we saw the systematic destruction, the dismantling of the Workers' Party as a ruling party by an elite conspiracy using the issue of corruption, which is rampant in Brazil, to carry out an attack not against those who are really culpable for the corruption, but those who are trying to expose it. That was certainly the case with Dilma Rousseff, the now impeached president of Brazil, who won the fourth election in a row for the Workers' Party. In Europe, however, we see the rising tide of national right-wing nationalism. In the United States, the victory of Trump. It's clear that this is not simply a countrywide phenomena, a regional phenomena. It is indeed a global phenomena. When one thinks back to the time period prior to World War II, during the 1930s, we could see that the tendency towards ultra-rightism and even fascism was not simply a manifestation of what went wrong in Italy or in Germany. It was, in fact, across the board, across continental Europe. Every country in Europe was under the sway of fascism by June 1940. Ultimately, the rise of the ultra-right, the rise of fascist tendencies, can't be seen independent from, apart from, the chronic problems of modern-day late-stage capitalism. As a consequence, the ruling elites, be they social democrats or liberal or right-wing center or right-wing conservatives, offering no solutions, open the gates to the flood of ultra-rightism and fascism. That poses new questions, new challenges, a paramount challenge for all authentically progressive voices, not just in Brazil, not just in Latin America, but indeed all over the world. We were joined by Alina Pive. She is a journalist and a member of the Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. We're talking to Alina from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And we were joined from Philadelphia by Joao Rodriguez, a longtime political activist in Brazil. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
As always, good to be back.
Large number of big issues that we're going to talk about this week. Let's get started.
All right. First, Facebook, this is coming from Ars Technica. Facebook has pulled a number of pages that they claim are tied to an Iranian effort due to inauthentic behavior, is what they say. So we're talking about 30 pages, 33 Facebook accounts, 16 Instagram accounts. And of course, Instagram is owned by Facebook now, and a few Facebook groups. What they're saying is that they found that this was somehow tied to Iranian groups, but they're actually being very careful to say it was not tied to the Iranian government just yet. But of course, this direction is coming from something we've talked about many times, the Atlantic Council, which Facebook has partnered with, a private group. They are basically NATO's, they're a NATO think tank effectively, and Facebook has partnered with them. So if you look at in this article and in some other places, you can see some of the pages, some screenshots that have been, of the pages and content that have been taken down. There's pages like No Racism, No War, that promotes, you know, pictures of Colin Kaepernick saying, you know, you're mad at me for kneeling, mad at Rosa Parks for sitting, and so on, expressing support for Kaepernick's, you know, protests during NFL games. Other items are The Thirst for Truth, which seems to be focused on UK politics. It talks about Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. What I found very interesting was this page, Wake Up America, that actually had been promoting anti-Trump content, but in the perspective of promoting the Russiagate idea. And so it's very clear that this is liberal and leftist content that has been primarily taken down and claiming that it is linked to some sort of Iranian influence campaign. And it's important to note that a couple weeks ago, Twitter also took down a number of accounts that they said were part of a similar campaign. There's been no statement from either Facebook or Twitter yet saying that this was that these accounts are related on both platforms. But it's a very coordinated effort, not just between these two companies, but overall to silence dissent on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all of these other platforms. It's a very scary time, especially given all of the recent news that we've been seeing.
You know, it does seem coordinated. They keep denying it or not commenting on it. And it seems clear to just about everybody else when Facebook takes down a page or closes an account, Twitter does the same thing within hours. There was one thing in this Ars Technica article that I thought was so interesting. Some of these pages and accounts were created as early as 2016, and there was only one very small ad buy. It was under $100 for two advertisements purchased in U.S. and Canadian currency. And apparently that was enough to raise a red flag for Facebook.
That's right. And the article even says most of their account activity was over the past year, had nothing to do with the 2016 election.
That's right.
Now, what we're looking at is increased claims that Russia and China and apparently Iran now are trying to interfere with next week's election.
Right.
There has been no proof.
Nothing.
Right. There has been no proof. And in fact, the biggest interference with the 2018 elections is voter suppression in the United States, states like North Dakota, Georgia, Alabama, and others. But they're trying to blame this, of course, on foreign actors, and especially foreign actors in countries that the U.S. establishment is not happy with: Russia, China, Iran. I expect that we're going to see more and more of this blame being spread around. Especially, we'll see what happens next week during the elections, who takes Congress and who takes certain, you know, state houses. But it's a very scary time, and we need to be very aware when we see these sorts of stories what the source is. And in this case, it's the Atlantic Council, which is very much a partisan and neoliberal organization.
Oh boy, is it. And in fact, it counts among its donors the governments of the United Arab Emirates, the government of the UK, Lebanese Saudi billionaire Baha Hariri, most of the big defense contractors. So it's not like they don't have
NATO.
Their own agenda. NATO
is a donor.
That's right. Well, let's go on to the next topic here, Chris. There's a piece entitled Blunt Policies and Secretive Enforcement Mechanisms, LGBTQ+ and Sexual Health on the Corporate Web. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is coming from the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And this is actually on the sort of on the same wavelength that really as the Facebook and Twitter stories that we've been seeing. What the EFF says here is that corporate platforms on the internet are being very restrictive and secretive about how they're suppressing certain types of expression, especially when it comes to content for the LGBTQ community. That can be content that is talking about how to be safe, content talking about supporting the LGBTQ community, and others. They tend to mark these, and they're talking specifically about YouTube primarily in this article. YouTube, of course, owned by Google. And they're saying that, you know, many channels, YouTube channels that provide content for the LGBTQ community are marked as adult. And a number of things happen when you're marked as adult. You're not going to show up in the default search results. You may not be able to monetize your channel. So you may not be able to have advertisements on your channel, which then make you money. And many of these video bloggers rely in full or in part on their channels for their income, because they may not be able to get a job elsewhere, or they're not making enough money at their at another job, and they have a community around them that is trying to support them and watch their videos. YouTube might disable custom thumbnails in the search results if you're even showing up in search results. And it cites a number of places, channels on YouTube that have been affected by this. And so this is it's very disturbing, because this isn't just the LGBTQ community. There are immigrant communities. There are Black-run channels that are, you know, explicitly political, that are also facing the same sort of censorship on YouTube and other video networks.
Chris, we've spoken on the show about a million times about Jeff Bezos. We're not fans of Jeff Bezos. And we've complained about several different policies that Amazon has enacted internally, things like workers' rights and minimum wage and working hours and benefits and things like that. This issue about Bezos, this is an article that appeared in Vanity Fair, is completely different. It's about Bezos's flirtation with ICE, and this is what's appalling Amazon employees. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. So Amazon, it's well known at this point, but Amazon has been working with ICE. They have a facial recognition technology called Rekognition. It's Rekognition. And it sells this technology to police departments, government agencies like DHS and like ICE. Now, Amazon employees have gone so far, and I think we talked about this last week, to say that they believe that their company should refuse to work with ICE, and the company should refuse to provide services to organizations like Palantir, which also provides software to ICE. Jeff Bezos, this says it, they're playing both sides. They say Bezos is still selling and making a ton of money through Amazon by selling, you know, all of these tools to Palantir, to ICE, and then, you know, kind of giving this double talk to his employees, saying that he cares about human rights and he cares about, about privacy. But the key is he wants profit. And this is not just, this isn't just Amazon. Microsoft is also defending its work with the U.S. military, and workers at Microsoft have been internally standing up to that and saying that they don't believe that Microsoft should be selling artificial intelligence software to the military, because it enables autonomous warfare. So basically, you know, even higher powered, smarter, I guess you could call them, drones that are weaponized to go, you know, to drop bombs. So this isn't just Amazon, right? This is Microsoft, this is Salesforce, and a number of other companies that are working with the military or militarized agencies like police and ICE inside the U.S. And I think there's a very strong movement inside the tech community, inside the tech worker sector, to say that, you know, these things cannot continue, and the workers are standing up. And it's a very impressive thing to see these workers doing that. But we have to see where it's going to go. Is Microsoft going to feel the pressure from its employees and from the public? Is Amazon going to feel that pressure? Or are they going to continue just to supply these agencies with these very dangerous tools?
One of the dangers here, too, and this is outlined by one of the Amazon employees quoted in the Vanity Fair piece, is that this technology is constantly improving. And so even if ICE is not able to make use of Microsoft or Amazon technology immediately to, let's say, increase detentions, apprehensions, expulsions of people, certainly that could happen in the near future.
That's right. You know, this technology moves very quickly. If you just look, you know, 10 to 12 years ago, the concern was license plate readers. You know, they put them on the back of tow trucks or police cars, and they say it was to find, you know, stolen cars. But really what happens is if you have a, you know, an outdated, you know, an overdue ticket, they, you know, hit your car for that. They tow you for whatever. And we've moved, the technology has moved so quickly that these same cameras or just more advanced versions of these cameras combined with this software can identify a person almost instantly, even if they're moving, even if there's a shadow on their face. This is particularly scary with Trump's announcement this morning that he could send thousands of troops to the U.S.-Mexico border to intercept this caravan that is coming up. We need to, privacy advocates and people who care about human rights overall need to be very concerned about what the Trump administration is actually going to be doing with this technology that is already in place, that Amazon has already developed this technology and is selling it to ICE and DHS.
By the way, John, you'll take us to the next story, but just before we do that, and we're going to do a segment on this today, another segment, but yes, the Pentagon is deploying up to 5,000, not 800 troops to the border to, quote, defend America against this caravan of migrant working class folks. Anyway, what's next? Let's go on.
Yeah, this is apps installed on millions of Android phones tracked user behavior to execute a multi-million dollar ad fraud scheme. This is from BuzzFeed. And I got to say, I know a lot of journalists at BuzzFeed. You can make all the fun about BuzzFeed that you want as being partisan, but these guys really know their stuff and do their jobs.
Absolutely. This story is from Craig Silverman, who writes some great stuff, and they did a very good investigation into this. Now, over 125 Android apps they looked at, tied to some websites that were part of a scam to, you know, get money from advertising companies. But the important part, and the reason I pointed this out, was that when these fraudulent companies purchased these apps from other developers, they continued to make updates to them so people would continue to use them. But they also added code that tracked how people were tapping and scrolling and interacting with these apps. And they used that to then privately in the background emulate those taps, those real human interactions, to make money from, you know, from advertisements. You know, when you see an advertisement, when you tap an advertisement, interact with it, it's called pay-per-click, right? So you can get 10 cents, you know, 5 cents, whatever it is, every time you interact with the advertisement. They were doing this in the background behind whatever game or utility it was that you were running, but they were tracking how you interacted with their app to make their fake interactions look more human. Now that's why I wanted to point this story out, that you know, that sort of analysis is very possible now with the amount of technology we have with the swipe recognition. And we've talked in the past about how apps can tell how you're holding your phone, you know, what angle it's at and things like that.
Oh my gosh. See, things like that scare the daylights out of me because it makes me feel like I've just completely lost control of my own phone. And with the phone, I've lost control of my own data.
And there's not much that can be done about this, unfortunately, not with current technology. Now, this is affecting, you know, ad sellers and ad developer, you know, ad networks. But it's not a difficult jump to see a message like, you know, or a technique like this being used to send fraudulent messages or to interact with, you know, with websites and put passwords in and things like that.
So, Chris, there was something that I saw in the mainstream media today that was perplexing to me. And that was that Facebook was fined only 500,000 British pounds for the Cambridge Analytica breach. Now, the Cambridge Analytica breach, our listeners ought to remember, was one of the most significant, most important data breaches in the history of Facebook. And there was a whistleblower involved. It was tied to the U.S. presidential election. 500,000 pounds, though, seems like an insult.
It really is an insult. It's barely a slap on the wrist. It's like a fly landed on Zuckerberg's hand and he didn't even notice when it flew away, really. You know, that's about $645,000 for our American audience, and it's absolutely nothing. Facebook is a multi-billion dollar company. Now, the reason this could have been a little more significant, it could have gone up to 17 million British pounds or about $22 million, which is the maximum amount allowed under the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation in the EU. Unfortunately, because the breach happened before the law went into place, they had to go back to their old their old maximum punishment for this. So if something happened again, Facebook could you know, see significantly larger penalties. But unfortunately, in this case, because of the way that the GDPR was written in the EU, they couldn't go back and retroactively apply it. 22 million still isn't all that much. It's 4% of the company's global turnover. But unfortunately, yeah, so unfortunately, they couldn't go back and apply that here.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk to Chris every Monday about big technology issues in this segment. It comes second in the first hour of Loud and Clear every week. And you're listening to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker and also co-host John Kiriakou. Chris Garaffa, many, many big stories on the technology front this week, as every week. Let's go on to Apple's radical approach to news. What's that?
So we got a huge, very long story in the New York Times from late last week highlighting Apple's approach to their Apple News product. So you can get this on your computer. You have it on your iPhone. You might actually see automatically the pop-up, the notification for breaking news stories from various outlets. So the way Apple has approached this is they say that instead of using computers and algorithms to pick the news that they feature, they are using humans. Well, I mean, that's nothing new, right? Newspapers for many, many years, centuries, have used humans to pick the paper. And the thing that concerns me about this is that they're saying this is some sort of brand new, amazing story and technique about how to provide news coverage to, you know, the millions and millions of people who have an iPhone. But these humans still have to be under the, you know, under some sort of corporate guidelines. The humans still have certain biases themselves. And I don't want to celebrate Apple just using people to select news when we've seen just the wide swath of censorship, even just what we've talked about today, against news, alternative news outlets. You don't see many alternative news outlets in Apple's picks. And if you can find them, they're very hard to find. They're, you know, hidden down in the bottom of the list, and Apple doesn't promote them at all. You're going to get, you know, major news media, the Mashable, the New York Times, the BuzzFeed, and, you know, sometimes you can get great stories out of them, but you're not going to get alternative media. You're not going to get RT, Sputnik. You're not going to get the anti-media on this. And so this idea that Apple is, you know, leading the way with having humans pick the news stories is just, it's just shocking to see that this is some sort of heralded as some sort of breakthrough, right? This is not a breakthrough. This is how news, you know, editorial staff have been working in newspapers for as long as there have been newspapers.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I actually get most of my news from social media, from things that people post, because otherwise I would normally miss it. There aren't enough hours in the day. But you're exactly right. Where I might be interested in something that appears in, let's say, Vox or Axios or RT, it's just not going to appear anymore on one of these Facebook feeds or Twitter feeds, for that matter.
That's right. They're making it very difficult. And when I say they, I mean, it's the entire mainstream tech industry is all of these companies that are not promoting independent news. They are doing the work at the behest of, you know, NATO through the Atlantic Council, the American government, regardless of who is running it. They're making it very difficult, more and more difficult, to see any sort of alternative news because they know what the power of the alternative news is. There's a long history of alternative radical newspapers and publications being suppressed back to, you know, earlier last century. This is nothing new. It's just happening online where there's a much wider reach. It's not somebody on the street handing out a pamphlet or a newspaper. It's somebody trying to share information to millions of people that they should be able to see.
Chris Garaffa, you sent us a fascinating article from a website called Engadget.com. It's entitled "Google's Smart City Dream is Turning into a Privacy Nightmare." I have to say, I'm not surprised. Are you?
Not surprised at all. When I first heard about this story a while ago, I thought it was immediately a privacy nightmare. So this is a partnership between a Google sister company. Google's parent company is called Alphabet. The sister company owned by Alphabet is called Sidewalk Labs, and they have they're working with the city of Toronto to turn some waterfront property into what they call a smart city. But effectively, what this is going to be is a city of surveillance. This is not going; it's not going to be a privacy haven for anyone. It's going to be a disaster. A nightmare is a nice way to put it, actually, from this Engadget article. Their lead consultant, Anne Kevorkian, just left the project because she was concerned about the fact that there was going to be very little oversight over the data that was going to be collected in this city. So let's talk about what that data is. There would basically be cameras everywhere to track traffic, car traffic, pedestrian traffic, business traffic, all of that. They would also, all of the in the buildings that were going to be built, they would actually be tracking who's turning the heat up, when the heat's being turned down. They say it would be for energy efficiency. But they weren't going to de-identify all this information until later in the process. Now, de-identifying says that I turn my heat up, it doesn't say Chris Garaffa turned his heat up to 70 degrees. It just says this happened approximately at this time, approximately at this location. Now, that needs to happen at the source. It can't happen later in the process because if it's intercepted, if it's logged anywhere, then it's very easy to track that information and create patterns and create a profile. And that wasn't part of the plan. And so this lead expert in privacy has actually left the project in protest of it.
Well, this woman, Anne Kevorkian, actually wrote the terms back in the 1990s that would have protected people's privacy. It says here that the company in the very beginning said, yeah, this is all a really great idea. And then they did nothing about it. They didn't act on it. The only thing that might save these people or the people of Toronto who might otherwise be living in this new development is the fact that at the end of the day, the whole thing has to be finally approved by the Toronto City Council. And that just may not happen. It says here in the article that that there have been what they describe as countless meetings with the public and with technology experts to explain the company's thinking and to make sure that everybody's concerns are considered in the master plan, which is supposed to be ready next year. But the city council hasn't accepted this notion of blanket surveillance, which is what it comes down to.
Unfortunately, though, Justin Trudeau is pushing this project and is pushing similar ideas in other cities. So we'll see politically where that comes out in a struggle between the city council and the partnership Justin Trudeau wants with Alphabet and Sidewalk Labs across Canada. This would be sort of a test project. And I think we need to look at some of the what Kevorkian has actually said to the Global News. She actually said, I'm sorry, I can't support this. I have to resign because you committed to embedding privacy by design into every aspect of your operation. And now that they've backed out, now that Sidewalk Labs has backed out of this, she has resigned from this project in a very strong protest. And I commend her for that.
Yeah. In fact, there are other activists, other digital activists in Canada who are saying the same thing that she's saying. The idea was to embed this privacy, to embed the anonymity in the program in the very beginning, back in the 1990s. They've decided that they can make more money by essentially collecting this data on people and monetizing it, selling it. She doesn't think that's right. There are others too. There's a woman named Sadia Muzaffar who founded it's something called Tech Girls Canada. She actually resigned from the country's digital strategy advisory panel for the same reason. And in a resignation letter, she said here that this development, this Waterfront Toronto development that we're talking about right now, has shown, quote, an apathy and an utter lack of leadership regarding shaky public trust and social license. The advisory panel was attended in good faith, but showed a blatant disregard for resident concerns about the data. It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, that the company is just trying to bulldoze this thing through the approval process, hoping that residents just get used to the idea that they're always going to be subject to surveillance.
John, I think you're absolutely right. They're looking at this and they're saying, well, this is going to happen. Sidewalk Labs is saying this is going to happen. Get used to it. And maybe we'll give you small concessions here or there. But here's the question. Why is it that there is going to be a private company or a group of private companies involved in building this new neighborhood? The private companies are concerned only with profit. And this is prime waterfront real estate for them in the city. So the city should be building housing. The city should be building all of these facilities and guaranteeing privacy. But instead, they've brought in private companies. Again, another private-public partnership that really just makes money for the private industry and has no concern for privacy, no concern for the rights of the people that are going to be living there.
We're running a little bit short on time, Chris, but you always give us a tech tip that is so important, we can't miss out on it this week. Go right ahead.
So the tech tip this week is to to keep your devices upgraded. Every time a software update comes out, the best thing you can do is run that update. Plug your phone into the charger, let it download, and take the 5-10 minutes to do it. The reason I bring this up this week is a story in Forbes that Apple, in its latest OS update, has prevented the Atlanta-based Grayshift company from getting into iPhones. Now, Grayshift sells this device to police and militaries all over the world now that they plug an iPhone into, and it's supposed to bypass your privacy settings and bypass your lock code. And it's a battle between Apple and Grayshift as to how they do this. But Apple has the upper hand with its iOS 12 update. So update your iPhone to iOS 12, and the current Grayshift devices will actually not be able to get your data off your phone if the police take it and try to plug it into one of these machines. So the Grayshift, which makes the gray key, they're being used, we know, in Rochester, Minnesota. They're actually being sold in the UK now. The NYPD has them. It is believed that the LAPD also has them. And the FBI has certainly had access to these devices. So they're being spread across the country. They're very expensive equipment. And thankfully, Apple has rendered them effectively useless with this latest update.
That's the voice of Chris Garaffa. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by Chris Garaffa. He's a web developer and technologist. Every Monday in this segment called A Weekly Guide on How Monopoly Corporations in the National Surveillance State are Threatening Cherished Freedom, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.